I want to speak to you tonight about understanding the Bible. In Luke chapter 10, there is the story of the lawyer who came to Jesus asking him the question, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus said to this man, "What is written in the scriptures? How readest thou?" In other words, what is your understanding of the scriptures? Now we imagine it should be easy to read the Bible. Nothing would seem simpler than to open the book and to read the verses as they came. But very few people read the Bible, and many people who do read it wrongly. There are those who treat it as a kind of religious charm to be looked upon with superstitious reverence. To them it's not a divine revelation at all. In fact, they don't expect to understand it. They expect to be mystified and bewildered by it. And, in some strange fashion, they think that the less they understand it, the better. Their attitude is rather like the old-fashioned attitude towards medicine. The nastier it tastes, the more good it does you. Well, how readest thou? How do you read the Bible? Have you any guiding principle, any method in the way that you read? Do you struggle on through verses and chapters and sometimes entire books as they come, sometimes knee-deep in terms and phrases and names that you don't understand, reading so many words and accepting everything and testing nothing, but just reading and treating what you read with uncomprehending reverence? Is that what you do? Because if it is, you won't get very far at all. Suppose you received a letter from a friend. How would you read that? Would you regard it as merely a collection of words and sentences? Or would you not look for the central message? I think you would ask yourself, what's the vital point? What's he trying to tell me? What does he want me to know? You wouldn't waste time examining the paper or the ink or counting the words. You would look for the message. And unless we treat the Bible, God's message to us, in the same way, we shall also read it mistakenly. And we shall be afraid every time some foolish person decides to make an attack on the Bible. Oh yes, the Bible has often been under attack in the course of history. Critics and unbelievers and atheists and so-called clever people alike have tried to destroy it. But we never need to be afraid that the arguments of people like these can ever take the Bible from us. They may rearrange chapters and verses to their heart's content. They may argue over authorship and point out what they imagine are mistakes and contradictions. But if we look at the Bible in the proper light, we shall understand that such people can never touch it, much less take it from us. Look for the message. How readest thou? Take the first chapters in the book of Genesis. How many people have been upset and hindered and bewildered by those chapters? I met some people not very long ago. When they read the book of Genesis, they looked for the wrong thing. They put the emphasis in the wrong place. And they would never think of reading a letter from a friend as they read the Word of God, because they never stopped to ask themselves, what are those chapters saying? Let me try to explain what I mean by emphasizing the wrong thing. And let me use as an example the story of the prodigal son. How do you read that story? What is it saying? Well, there's really only one message in that parable, at least one message that we need to concern ourselves with. I've preached on the parable a great many times, and I've pointed out how wonderfully Jesus makes little things carry a message. We could never exhaust the story. We could sift through every word if we had the time and find it full of jewels. But the fact is, the message can be summed up in two words. Come home. Or you could have a wonderfully pointless discussion about the prodigal son. You might, for example, argue as to upon what day of the week he went away from home. If you put that question to the scholars, on what day did the prodigal leave home? Well, there are 7 days in a week, and you would find somebody who would argue that he went away on every single one of those different days. And you would end up by having 7 different theories about the day of the week on which the prodigal left home. And if you went and asked the question, on what day did he come back, you'd get the same thing all over again. But would they be discussing the parable? Would they really be entitled to call themselves Bible students? Would they ever be likely in that way to come to the real message of the story? Of course not. They would be losing everything, simply because they were beginning at the wrong place and looking for the wrong thing. The message of the parable is, come home. Your father is waiting for you. So to come back to the chapters in Genesis there, the chapters which tell of the creation of the world. You get the scholars, the biologists, the anthropologists, the geologists, and they all come to the book of Genesis to argue. And all the troubles we have. One is looking for evolution, and he interprets the chapters in Genesis to suit the theory. Another is looking for evolution, and he doesn't think he can find it in Genesis, and so he abandons the whole Bible. Somebody else comes looking for a universe that came out of a great fire mist, or out of a great explosion, or something else. But look, I'm not concerned with their theories. I want to know what the Bible is trying to tell me. I can spend a lifetime trying to harmonize the chapters in Genesis with so-called science and still miss the message. What is the Bible saying? It is saying that God created everything. And if you just don't know how God created, if you can't be sure of the method that he used, you don't give up the Bible because of that any more than you give up the story of the prodigal son just because you don't know on what day of the week he left home. I don't really care how the feast was spread when the boy came back. I don't care who the waiters were. I know that he came home, and I want to follow his example. Now, the Bible is concerned that you should know that God created the heavens and the earth. If you were told exactly how God did it, in scientific terms, you wouldn't understand it anyway. But that too may come in due time. And for that matter, can you imagine the kind of Bible you would have if God had satisfied the curiosity of the scientists and described creation in detail? Why, you wouldn't be able to lift such a book, much less understand it. And yet one day, God may see fit even to explain that and answer all their questions. But you see, there are some people who will insist on knocking on doors that are still marked private. You can't get rid of trespassers and intruders. They rush in where angels fear to tread. If we love the Bible, we'll want to learn from it, and we shall see that the plain, simple message of the book of Genesis is that God created. But then again, no sooner are we past the creation story than we come to the story of Adam and Eve and the temptation in the garden. Well, what is your understanding of the Scriptures? What do you make of it? How readest thou? Here again, you see, many people have been troubled by the story of the fall of our first parents. But it's because they haven't looked for the central message in the story. They've puzzled themselves over trivial and unimportant details with which they have no real business. We read that the serpent tempted Eve, and she did eat. How did he tempt her? Did he point to the fruit on the tree? Or did he put the fruit into her hand? Or was it an apple or a pear? Who knows? And who cares? Because it doesn't really matter. What really concerns us is there's one thing to notice in the story of what happened in the garden, and it's this. The human heart was tempted. And all of history testifies to this. And our own heart bears witness to the truth of it too. Forget everything else in that chapter in the Bible. Leave all these questions for other times and other places, but take hold on this fact. The human heart disobeyed God, and ever since, man has disobeyed and has eaten things that have been bad for him. And you and I both have stood where Eve stood, and you and I both have listened to Satan rather than to God. What is that chapter really telling us? It's telling us how sin came to mankind. But let's advance a little more into the Bible and come to Sinai. How readest thou? What you would think about when we get to the great mountain? Shall we listen for the thunders, look for the lightnings? Shall we ask whether Moses wrote the law or whether God wrote it with his own finger? Shall we argue as to what language he wrote in or what the words would look like or how big the tables of stone were? By all means, ask the questions if you feel you have to. But I warn you, they're questions for foolish people. They're not for you and me. What is the question? Well, the question really is, has any distinction been made between right and wrong? And Sinai gives the answer. It tells us that there has a distinction been made. But shall we discuss the number of commandments that God gave and ask why there were 10 and not 12? Or shall we debate the order of the commandments? Or even discuss, as did the Pharisees in the day of Jesus, which is the most important of the 10. Well, if we did things like these, we should be wasting our time and missing the story of Sinai, missing its meaning. The fact is that God gave to his people principles by which they were to live. God drew lines between right and wrong, good and bad. And we can't get rid of these lines even today. They're in our homes, in our work, in our business, in our schools. They're the very life of society. And even though the laws of Sinai were part of a covenant which has been done away, and which has been replaced by a better in Jesus Christ, the moral laws which God gave still apply today. It is still wrong to steal, friends, wrong to kill, wrong to covet, wrong to commit adultery, no matter what the world says, or how the world excuses these things. Sinai says, right is never wrong, and good is never evil. And one day, all men will have to be judged by that fact. But let us continue. This last point that I've made reminds me that a great many people have a deal of trouble with the wars and the destruction of the Old Testament. They are constantly asking why it is that God commanded the destruction, say, of the Canaanites. Why God commanded that a nation should be wiped out. But strange as it may seem at first glance, that really isn't the point. The thing that we need to recognize is that God is at the back of everything shaping man's destiny. God is at the heart of the affairs of men, working things out so that one day righteousness will be supreme, and all wickedness, such as that of the Canaanites and all other opposing forces, will go. And remember, this does not mean that God has a plan which he intends to force through regardless of human welfare. Because God has no interests which are not consistent with our eternal well-being. That is the key to the whole Bible, in fact. I don't care what God's men make for themselves. My God, the God of the Bible, is a loving, eternal, omnipotent Father. And this God is only concerned with our salvation. This God is working out nothing that is inconsistent with our good. And even when God exercises judgment, he is still a God of love. And even when he's a consuming fire, when the full story is told, we shall learn that God never destroyed anything that might have been saved. But come over to the New Testament for just a minute. When you come to the cross of Christ and read the story of Calvary, how readest thou? Oh, how many theories have been devised about the atonement, and how many hair-splitting theologians have gathered about the cross to argue when they ought to have been on their knees in worship. They've debated on the extent of the atonement, whether Christ's blood was shed for the elect only, or for all men. They've argued about the shape of the cross, and whether it really was a cross or just a stake. They've argued about the nails of the cross, and about the spot where it happened. But there's one lesson we're expected to learn at Calvary, and it's this. Christ died for our sins. Now that is what the cross means. That is the all-inclusive, all-embracing, and all-explaining word. He loved me and gave himself for me. And if you add one line to that, your addition becomes subtraction. If you begin to speculate and argue, you've missed everything. Men only argue at the foot of the cross when they're self-satisfied, when they're blind. On the other hand, when they are sorry for their sins, and convicted, and broken-hearted, and blind with tears, they see the great meaning of the cross, because it shines with a wonderful light. Pilate wrote above the cross in Greek, and Hebrew and Latin. But above all this is written the true meaning of the cross. For God so loved the world, that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. This is what we all must learn. Have you learned it yet? Finally, let me take you to what is often called the Great Commission, as recorded in Mark chapter 16, verses 15 and 16. You will remember that this is at the time that Jesus has been raised from the dead. The possibility of salvation has been secured for all men. And now he instructs his apostles as to the message, the gospel, they are to take to the world. His words are brief and simple. Go ye into all the world, and preach the gospel to every creature. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. He that disbelieveth shall be condemned. Now one would think that the instructions here were so straightforward and simple as not to be capable of being misunderstood. And yet how many arguments have raged around the Great Commission? Does one have to believe before one is baptized? Does one have to be baptized anyway? Can one not be saved without baptism? Is baptism an essential or a non-essential? Is it for salvation or because of salvation? And so the discussion goes round and round and round and round. But how readest thou? What does Jesus say? Well, let us take the passage as it comes. Go ye into all the world. Well, that surely includes the place where you are at this moment. If you are anywhere in the world, this is for you. And preach the gospel to every creature. If you are a rational, intelligent being, this is also for you. If you are capable of hearing the gospel and understanding it, Jesus means you. He that believeth, so one has to believe, one has to have faith, and is baptized, so after belief comes baptism, shall be saved. So after belief and baptism is the promise of salvation. Now someone is almost sure to retort, well, Jesus says, he that believeth not shall be condemned. He doesn't say, he that is not baptized shall be condemned. No, that's quite true. Jesus does not say that. But only because Jesus Christ never spoke rubbish. He never wasted time stating the obvious. He has already said that faith comes first. It is he that believeth, really believes, who will be baptized, because Jesus Christ commands it. And anyone who does not believe, obviously, is not going to obey Christ. It is all a matter of the way in which you read. Jesus is emphasizing the positive side of the gospel message. He is stressing how people are to be saved, not how they're to be condemned. And the logical fact is that if they do not do what they're commanded in order to be saved, they're going to be condemned. Suppose I said to you, if you will go to the bank on Monday morning at 10 o'clock and present my name, you will receive £1,000. Would it also be necessary for me to say, and if you don't go and you don't present my name, you won't receive the money? So with the Great Commission. Why waste time with the negative aspect when Christ is offering salvation? Look what he offers. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. How readest thou? Read to receive salvation, not condemnation. Just